call for all of you to come on in and join us in Tippy Talk on Books I Love. Welcome to Tippy Talk this morning, as this is where we talk about published authors as well as unpublished authors and wannabe authors. We also speak to readers and publishers and all other things related to the written word. My name is Tippy Felsenstein, and today I have an exciting author for you. So if you have a story to tell and want to write it down in a book or an essay, you especially have come to the right place. If you've written a book and want to speak about it, this is also it. If you read a book and want to either discuss it or speak with an author, you're also in the right place, because this is where the authors get a chance to speak and the readers get to enjoy the written word, where publishers can find talent and display their found talent. Books are the treasure. They give us new ideas. They guide us when we're lost and go through centuries of wisdom and entertainment. This is where the written word will survive and thrive. And today, our author is Stephen Swerdley. He graduated from Arizona State University with a BS in biology. And then he spent his career being a salesman and a super salesman, and then a super-duper salesman, which we will talk about, because it takes a lot of work to be a salesman. And today we get to talk to Stephen Swerdley directly about his book that he wrote, Enemy in the Heartland. But he's also an author of a second book called Revenge Unleashed. So we're going to hear all about that. And I'm really excited to welcome you, Stephen. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us, and welcome to Tippy Talk.
Thank you for having me on your show today.
I am really, really happy to talk to you. I'm really excited because you're not somebody that has been writing for a long time. You have a really great story, and you have an amazing book here that I have the gist of the book, which is an attack on the central United States kills thousands of Americans, but also caused the lives of most of the fanatics. Not satisfied with the damage already done, the surviving extremists vow revenge. Their target is the men who played a key role in bringing their compatriots to justice, the President of the United States. Standing in the way is a super-secret international center terrorism group determined against overwhelming odds to prevent another disaster. That sounds really, really intriguing and a really great story. So I want to know how you came up with the story. But before we do that, Stephen, why don't you tell us a little bit about you? We know you graduated as a biology major. Did you want to be a doctor?
Yeah, I've got a couple relatives, you know, in the past that were a doctor or taught surgery. And so I wanted to get into med school, but the problem was, being the oldest of 12 kids, I had to pay my own way through college. And so I was a bartender, so that kind of messed up my GPA to get into med school. So, but everything worked out for the best. But I started to use the biology degree when I first got out of college selling medical equipment, but then I got kind of bored with that and went into other industries.
And then, so you became, the first job that you had was a salesman in the medical equipment industry?
Yeah, I got into it back in the early 80s, so I'm dating myself, or actually late 70s. And then I progressed into other lines of equipment sales, doing reprographic equipment, you know, blueprint machines, robots for the semiconductor industry, and then automotive equipment and automotive software. You know, so I kind of bounced around about every 3 or 4 years for different opportunities.
So you enjoy selling? Was that it? Do you enjoy being a salesman? Because obviously you did really well with that.
Yeah, selling's kind of like playing poker. It's a game, you know. It's kind of fun to go out. I love, you know, hanging with people. You know, if you want to punish me, put me in a closet where I can't talk to anybody. So I love to go out and travel around the United States in somebody else's nickel and sightsee and make deals. And so it was a lot of fun. And then I got to work for two European companies, one based out of Germany and one based out of Italy. So I got to go overseas, you know, during my tenure as a, you know, national sales manager.
Wow, that sounds like fun, actually. You get to travel on somebody else's dime, you go everywhere, and you're always with people, so definitely has a plus to it. So that sounds great. So how did you transition from being in sales into writing this amazing book, which was the first one that you wrote, which was Enemy in the Heartland?
Well, what happened was July 7, 2013, I had a stroke. And didn't see it coming, didn't feel it coming. You know, I was on blood pressure medicine, so, you know, I thought it was all right. But I went in one day to watch some NASCAR on a Sunday morning with a couple buddies. And I was so tired all of a sudden I couldn't keep my eyes open. And then after the race was over, my wife and I jumped out in the pool when it was 112 degrees, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And about 1:30, you know, half hour later, she was kind of hungry, so I got out of the pool to turn on the barbecue grill, and when I reached down for the towel and stood up, I fell over backwards, landing on a couple of pool recliners. I'm going, uh-oh, that's weird. So I walked into the house, and when I saw my face in the mirror, my left eye was stuck in the left socket, you know, in the left side of the socket, and I'm going, oops, that's not good. That's a stroke. I've had some friends and relatives that had strokes. So we rushed down to the hospital immediately. And I'll tell you one thing to your listeners. If they have the luxury of having multiple hospitals in their area to go to, before you ever have a problem, go ask your doctor which hospital, if you have a stroke or a heart attack or something major happening to you, which hospital should you go to or not go to? Because I found out really quick there's good hospitals and bad hospitals.
Oh, my God. You're so right. I never even thought of that. All hospitals are horrible, but there are some better than others. But,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good idea to check out the hospitals in the area. I mean, wow, that is a great tip. Thank you.
Yeah, because, you know, what happened was when I got to the hospital, they had all the equipment, you know, MRIs, CAT scans, all these different, you know, pieces of equipment. But this hospital had been there for 40 years. It didn't have a neurology department. And then the day after I had the stroke, you know, I had to spend the night in there. And the guy that worked on me in the emergency room says, hey, I don't like this place. I have to let you go because we can't find your stroke. You know you had one. I know you had one. But I got to release you. And he gave me his business card. In the back of his business card, he said, here's an appointment to go see one of the top 10 neurologists in the country. He's over on the other side of town in Glendale, Arizona. And I got an appointment with you and him for Wednesday. And, you know, this is Monday. He's telling me this. He says, if you have a problem, don't come back here. Go somewhere else.
Wow.
You know, until you see that doctor. And so, long story short, 2 days later when I went to see the neurologist, my wife drove me, and he didn't have my records yet, which was kind of surprised because everything's electronic now. And I said, well, why don't I come back when you have my records? He says, no, I'll see you now. And I said, well, why? Don't you want your records? He says, no, you had a stroke. And I said, well, how do you know that? He says, I'm a neurologist. And, you know, I'm going, okay, this guy's cool. And, you know, what he told me was this, and this is the scary part. It's amazing how much better the technicians are in finding things on scans or x-rays if I tell them where to look. And I said, well,
wow.
It's in the back of my skull, bottom here, you know, bottom right inside of my skull, because that's part of the brain that controls your automatic nervous system, your eyes, you know, all that stuff. He says, you're right. I said, well, why couldn't they find it when I was in there? He says, because you had, you know, so much oxygen in your system because you're in good shape, you know, and jog and play golf and stuff. Your sinuses clouded the image. But when I got the x-rays or the scans, he said, there it was right there. But he says, you were lucky. So like I say, whenever you're in seeing your doctor for a check or something, just say, hey, if something really bad happens to me, where should I go?
Right. That's a great idea because my motto is The only way I get to a hospital is on a stretcher. I go to hospitals. But ignoring it, that's when you pay the price, because you could have actually died when he told you to go home. If you weren't in such a good shape, you could have died. I mean, here you have a stroke. Yeah. You should be treated, not sent home.
Well, put it this way. For 2 weeks afterwards, I was so tired. I couldn't hardly get off the living room couch. And I have a two-story house. And it took me a month before I had strength again to go up the stairs. And now here, I was a guy that walked, you know, 2 or 3 miles every day with the dogs and played golf and did some other stuff. You know, I was very active. But, you know, all of a sudden I was fatigued out, and I lost some of my capability of speaking to people. I couldn't look at people in the eyes. And for some reason, my vision would just kind of look for other things to look at when I talked to people. And my speech patterns and stuff, I've probably lost about 20-25% of my capability to communicate verbally with people. And it took time for me to get that back. And so my wife, who is a psychologist, so prayed for me. She said, hey, I want you to start writing books. Because in the meantime, after I had the stroke, about 4 months later, I lost my job. The company I was working for laid me off. You know, they didn't think I could travel and stuff anymore, and which wasn't so. But so anyway, so she said, hey, for therapy, and get your brain back in shape and your speech patterns and stuff, because I could see words, but I couldn't say them, you know. So she said, why don't you start writing those books that you had in mind? So, you know, I thought about it for a while, and I'd never written anything longer than a sales report, you know, in my life. And, you know, and so I wanted to write about something that I wouldn't have to explain to people. And while I was laying around on the couches for hours every day, you know, trying to get my strength back, you know, all I saw on TV, you know, on the news was terrorism and drones. I'm going, there we go. That'd be a good story to talk about.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is really that you always wanted to write? Is that why your wife said that? Was it something that you discussed?
Well, it's something that she wanted me to do to kind of, you know, as a mental therapy. And, you know, when you're a salesperson, you're always telling stories, you know. And so, and when I was a kid in college, you know, attending bar, you heard all kinds of stories. So it just kind of all started to gel. And so one day I came up into my bedroom office at the house and start, you know, writing an outline and start typing it. And 4 months later, I wrote my first novel. It was 430 pages long when it finally came out in print. But the hardest part wasn't so much writing the book, it was getting the book to market.
Not the editing? You mean actually?
Well, that's what
marketing?
I'm talking about. You know, I did. It was all the marketing and getting the book to market. I mean, I didn't know an editor, so I had to go on a website called Thumbtack and look for editors around, you know, Phoenix area to edit it. And, you know, some of the people I ran into were going, oh, what a marvelous story. And I'm going, yeah, you guys don't know anything. You know, I wanted somebody who was, you know, really critical. And some people didn't want to do it because of religious belief. And then one guy called me up one day and said, I read your first two chapters. How accurate do you want the book to be? And so I wanted accurate because, you know, a lot of military people are going to read it. You know, people in the, you know, the FBI, police force and stuff like that. That's where it's geared to. And he said, well, you got a mistake in the first, couple pages. I said, well, he says, yeah, in your list of characters. I said, I didn't even make it to the prologue of the first chapter. He says, no. So I said, so what's the mistake? He says, you got a sergeant flying an Apache gunship, and that can't happen. I said, well, why? How do you know? Were you in the military? Because I was never in the military. He says, no. I was a PR director for Boeing Helicopter out here in Mesa, Arizona, and so whenever there was a helicopter movie set, he'd be there as a technical advisor. So I said, you and I need to talk. And so that's how I found my, you know, editor, and then I had to find a, you know, cover designer and somebody to format the books and stuff. So it took about 9 months to get all that put together. But the second time, you know, for the second book, it took me about 6 months to write the sequel because I wanted the sequel to be a standalone book so that people, if they read it first, they'd want to go back and read the first one. But, it was like starting a new business. And when you go write books, nobody tells you how to do it unless you went to some literary class in college. But, the the publishing industry is changing so much, you know, like everything else. You know, it's what you did 2 years ago, you don't do the same today.
Nobody tells you how to do anything these days. Everything you want to do, you have to kind of figure out yourself.
I mean, you know, when you want to have somebody help you on the phone, you call some company and they put you on hold, or there's an automatic answering service and you don't know which number to press.
Yeah, you're lucky if you get to talk to someone, that's for sure. So how long did it take you to write the first book?
First book took 4 months to write, and pretty quick. That was
yeah.
it, you know. And, you know, because it was pretty simple in my mind after watching TV for, you know, a couple months on my back. It was pretty easy for me to figure it out. But, you know, it's a book about a bunch of terrorists that met each other in school over in England at a college. And then 13 years later, they come over to the United States and you know, conceive, you know, during those 13 years, they conceive a strike against the United States because a lot of their relatives were killed during Desert Storm days, and they had a lot of money to put into their effort. So, you know, they were pretty organized when they came over to the United States. And bottom line is they steal a bunch of military drones off a army base and hook them up with some poison gas cylinders, and they go out and attack the United States.
So you formulated the story as you were writing or as you were watching TV?
As I was writing. And
mm-hmm.
the characters in the book, you know, I'd be thinking, okay, who would this character be? You know, and I would visualize each character, you know, and those characters would be old friends of mine or old business contacts. So sometimes the old adage, bitches of payback, came out in the book because, for example, my old boss that I worked for a number of years, he was one of the main characters, and I killed him off. So, you know, it was kind of funny because I got a lot of phone calls after the book came out. Well, yeah, a lot
yeah.
of people are going, would you put me in your book for like that? And, you know, I changed their names a little bit, but they knew who they, you know, the characters were when they read the books.
Right. They know. They can recognize themselves, but nobody else knows. So that's one of the nice things about books, that you could kill off characters and give rebirth to characters and basically do whatever you want, especially if it's fictional.
Yeah, well, one of the funniest things about when I was getting close to finishing the book, you know, I used to travel 45 weeks a year as a sales manager, you know, national sales manager. And, you know, so once I had the stroke, you know, I was home all the time, which was a huge change of a way of life for me. And so my wife, you know, like I say, who was a psychologist, she'd come up in the afternoon about 4:30 or 5 and say, hey, knock it off. It's time to quit at the end of the day. And I'm used to working till like 9, 10 o'clock at night, you know, on my travels. And so one day she brought up a glass of wine and said, hey, time to knock it off. And I had just got into a battle scene in the book towards the end of the first book. And I had a turn like, because like I said, I'd knocked off one of the main characters. A good guy. And she said, what's wrong? And I told her, and she says, well, you can't kill everybody off. I said, why? She says, well, you need a sequel. So that's how the second book came. You know, it wasn't, I didn't even have any idea about writing a second book until that happened.
So it was a natural progression. That's really the best books that ever come out, is books that come out, they kind of flow out of you. You know, you have an idea of what you're going to write, but when you write, things just, the story drives you rather than you drive the story. That's what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get up in my bedroom office, you know, about 8 o'clock in the morning after walking dogs and doing, you know, all the little goofy things you have to do in the morning. And, you know, before I knew it, it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd go get a sandwich downstairs and come back up. And then the next thing I knew, it was, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock, and, you know, my wife would be yelling for me downstairs, stop, get down here, relax. But I will say that the books did help me get my thought process back, and in doing all the interviews since the books, and thank you again for letting me be on your show, but the interview process has really helped me get my speech pattern back and stuff, because most people who have never, you know, known me before the stroke, you know, can't believe that I did have a stroke.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So you healed, you came up with a great book, and you changed everything that you ever did before. So definitely this was a life changer. The stroke changed everything in your life. Would you say at the end of the day when you look at it that it ended up being a good thing?
I don't wish a stroke at anybody, but, you know, I believe that I'm a very, very lucky person to be around, because I should have been dead, number one. And I'm very thankful for the love and support my wife has given me, you know, to give me time to heal and stuff. And, you know, when you have a life-threatening incident, you know, all of a sudden you realize you're mortal, and things do change in your views. You know, I'm still kind of corny, and I go around and tell people, you know, hey, if you get a problem, I'm brain dead, so that's my excuse. But, you know, you kind of think about what's going to happen. You know, you know, in 10 years I could be dead, and, you know, and you kind of wonder, is anybody ever going to remember me? So I guess the books are kind of like a way to, you know, believe some type of footnote in history that, hey, I was here.
Yeah, that too. That's true. The realization that we're not going to be here forever. Would have been really nice if I realized it when I was 16. I think my life would have taken a different shape. But that usually happens when you either get to a certain age where you realize you don't have forever, or something happens where you get sick or an accident or something like that. That's really true. So being in the sales industry and being a salesman for so many years, did that help you with marketing the book?
Not really. You know, the only thing I can say is being a salesperson, you have to be a detective. You have to go out and find what your customers need and service them and give them what they actually want at a good price. But when it comes to, you know, getting a book out to, you know, the public, there's 5,000 new books a day that hit the streets. And so just the sheer number of competition is overwhelming. And
but none of the books are your books. None of the books are this book. So in itself, it's not a competition. There are a lot of other books that try to get people's attention, but this story is very uniquely your story.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, because when you go onto Amazon and read the reviews, they've all but two have been 5-star reviews, you know, and some of the people have written some pretty lengthy reviews, and to me, that's where the rewards come in from the book. It's not monetary, but what other people think of your writing. Because I'll tell you, the first time I gave my transcript to the editor, Ken, my friend now, it was like burying your soul. I mean, because all your psyche's wrapped up into the script and everything, and, you know, don't hurt my baby, don't kill my baby, and it turned out really, really good. You know? And then when the first printed copy was handed to me, I mean,
wow.
It was big and thick and everything. And I mean, I got a tear to my eye. It was like having a baby.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it was. As a matter of fact, I think it took me a year before I was able to give the entire manuscript to someone and trust them to look at my baby. I didn't realize that. You don't realize that. And I think it's with any creative process. I know a painter that paints a lot of paintings, but he doesn't want to sell them, and I never understood what the thing was, and I think he feels like his baby, he doesn't want to part with them.
Yeah, you don't want somebody beat you up for, you know, doing a good job, and you're going, oh, God, I hope they like it, you know. So it is intimidating.
Yes, yes. It's putting yourself out on the limb, but the reward is just as big also. And so do you think you're going to be writing for the rest of your life?
Well, you know, when you're 65 now and have a stroke and you've been laid off, there aren't a lot of opportunities. So, you know, I did some substitute teaching just to get out of the house because I was going stark raving mad sitting up in my office all the time. So, you know, I think I'm going to continue to do some substitute teaching because it's kind of fun being around little kids. They actually are little terrorists that are under control, it seems like. But, you know, I'm going to do that probably more so, you know, in the future. But I'm going to continue to write the books because, you know, my thing is this: the way I write the books, it's almost like a movie screenplay, and it's easy to follow. You know, there's, you know, and if you can visualize things when you read, you're going to enjoy these books because they're fast. They start out kind of slow because you have to get all the characters kind of lined up, but I write the books on the basis of 6 degrees of separation. You know, somebody somewhere knows somebody. And fate, you know, if you go on and took a left-hand turn versus right-hand turn, you know, what would have happened? So between those two premises, those were what the books are based on, and also, you know, kind of like real-life scenarios that you see out there all the time. So, I mean, terrorism is not going to go away, and the books are based on really something that happened in the 70s. Remember when the Olympics happened, where over in Germany the Israeli
Munich,
athletes were
yeah, the
attacked?
Munich terror. Yeah, the Munich
Yeah,
terror.
so the premise of the books are, you know, future wars are not going to be fought between nations. There's going to be future wars are going to be nations fighting terrorist groups. And so because of that Munich incident, a bunch of the larger nations around the world, the U.S., Germany, so on and so forth, they formed a secret organization, kind of like Interpol, but it was called the Olympic Committee. And these guys from all these different countries would share intelligence, excuse me, intelligence info on terrorists. And, you know, and they'd find something here or there, and all of a sudden they found this plot coming to the United States, but they weren't quite sure how, when, and where. And so it's kind of like a chase against time, kind of like that TV series 24. It's kind of like a chase in time. The good guy's going to catch the bad guys before a bunch of people get killed. And that's the premises of the book.
Well, I certainly hope that terrorism will go away, and I certainly hope that this planet will evolve eventually, I don't know how soon, to a level where we could actually coexist without killing each other. I do agree that the wars will not be fought between nations. They will be fought the way they are right now. There are 250,000 cars being blown up annually in France that we don't even hear about because it's such a commonplace, and there are terrorism acts everywhere all the time. I love the concept of your book. It sounds like it's an amazing read. So if somebody wants to get the book, where do they go?
Well, if they want a signed copy, they should go to my website, www.stephenswortlandauthor.com, and I'll
Can you spell your
sign
name?
the
Spell your name out.
Yes, Stephen was the PH, and then Swortley is SCHWERT as in Tom, LEY, so it's StephenSwortlandAuthor.com. Or they can go on to Amazon.com and look for Enemy in the Heartland or Revenge Unleashed.
So there you go.
And they can
That's
get
where
an
you can get
e-book,
it.
so
I
it's pretty.
will. Yeah, if you're
Go ahead.
also listening to this on the internet, I will put the link to those two places, to your website and to the Amazon, right here below on the introduction. So you will be able to access it that way. I will highly recommend reading the book if you want to enjoy a good book. If you're the kind of person that wants to curl up and just read a good book, I promise you're going to start reading the book. You're probably not going to want to put it down until it's finished. So I guess maybe it should be more like a weekend project, not a one-day project.
Yeah, it's a good beach book or one of those cabin books.
Yeah, and for the summer, it's a great gift also. And thank you so much for writing it. I think you did an amazing job. I haven't read the whole book, but the parts that I have read is really intriguing. So it's the kind of book that you cannot read part of and not want to finish it and see what happens because it's very well put together. It's an amazing, great job for the first book that somebody ever writes. I think it's an amazing job. And now you know where you can get the book. And before we run out of time, do you have any last words that you would like to say?
I would say that, you know, anybody that wants to write a book, I think everybody's got a book inside them. You know, it might be a short book, a comic book, a love story or novel, I mean. But if you're going to do it, start writing. And the thing that helped me doing my books, because my books were very complex into characters and timing and locations, start an outline. And then when you get to a certain point, go back on your outline and make sure all the things that you want to cover are in what you're writing. And that will help you stay focused throughout the book. So, you know, and always remember one thing, you know, nobody knows the book as well as you do. So don't worry if you forget something.
That's a really great idea. It's a great tip. Start with an outline if you think it's overwhelming. Once you have an outline, it's so much easier to fill in between the outline.
That's right.
And sit down and do it. Write it. Don't procrastinate. That's really also a good tip. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, and so this is basically what we're talking about, is your first book that you wrote, is Enemy in the Heartland. And now we will come back and discuss Revenge Unleashed, which is your second book, which is a sequel, but you also said that it will stand alone. So we will come back and discuss that one. So stay tuned. Steven Swartley, I said Swartley, I guess. Swartley? You pronounce it Swartley, right?
I answer to about everything.
Oh, there you go. Call him anything, but just call. And stay tuned. We will be coming back and talking about Revenge Unleashed. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve. This has been really wonderful. I want to hear more about your books. I think everybody wants to hear more about your books and more about you and how you're doing. And how are you doing now with the stroke? Are you 100% better, or where would you say you stand?
Well, it's always hard to figure out what's, you know, how your body's doing after a stroke versus old age. So, you know, I don't run as fast as I used to, but I think I'm pretty much recovered, and my sense of humor is still as warped as ever. So I guess I'm pretty much back to normal, whatever normal is.
Well, your normal is probably different than somebody else's normal. So you're back to being able to walk as much as you want. You're not as tired anymore. You feel
yeah.
Healthy.
Yeah, I'm out golfing and stuff and, you know, doing things I used to. You know, it's like I said, I don't run 100-yard dash anymore. But, you know, I enjoy life more so every day, and every day is a new challenge. So, you know, it's good.
Wow, thank you so much. You are listening to Tippy Talk on Books I Love with Steven Swartley, author of Enemy in the Heartland, and to be coming soon also Revenge Unleashed. So there you go. We have come to the end of our time together here on Books I Love. It has been wonderful talking to you, Steve. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Books I Love. We bid you a magical journey and let your talent be your potion. My name is Tippi Felsenstein.